it tends to be a little bit more word-based just to kind of trigger conversations and thought starters. So we'll try to get to the, what are the client's core values? What are their core attributes? What maybe are some of the personas that they might identify with? It's just kind of like a fun series of exercises in which we can get to know the client in a way that is outside of design.
Hello and welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography. Today we are speaking with Andrew Ashy, principal and co-founder at AMP Studio, with his partner Anne Marie. AMP Studio, spelled capital A, lowercase MP, is licensed to practice architecture in not only Ontario, Canada, I imagine, California, and of course, Maine. Ashy received a master's degree of architecture from Yale University, a Master of Arts in Media from the New School, and a Bachelor of Science with a concentration in architecture from Northeastern University. He has over 15 years of professional experience, bringing in an expertise in residential, commercial, and institutional design. Prior to founding AMP, he was a senior designer at Wrapped Studio in Los Angeles, an associate at Joel Sanders Architect and Handel Architects in New York, and a designer at Util in Boston. Our interview today is sponsored by Maine Home Design. Don't miss Ashy's Design Theory article in the upcoming September issue of Maine Home Design. Please welcome Andrew Ashy. Welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography. And Andrew Ashy, not yes. Ashley.
That's right.
You must get that a lot.
Yeah, a surprising amount, actually. And my entire family as well. So we've gotten used to it.
So go ahead and pull this guy like right up to you there. You want it roughly about a fist length away from your face.
Right.
And that way we get great audio that people can just melt into as they mow the grass or keep designing or whatever it is that people do when they're watching this kind of thing.
All right.
I'm usually mowing the grass probably.
Hopefully that's better.
Or taking a walk. Who knows? Anywho, Andrew Ashy, thanks for joining us. I looked through your about page on your website and all the work on your website I'm very envious of. It's all very, very nice and minimal, I'll call it. Like when I see it, there's something odd about me. Like when I see work like yours, it's similar to, like, I mean, Util Design.
Mm-hmm.
Like there, you've worked at Util and done a lot of different things with other studios that the studios that you've been at and the stuff that I've seen from your website just has this emotional connection of calm for me. And it's like, you know, this very minimalist stuff that I don't know why it makes me feel that way, but I just gravitate towards it when I see very flowy, fluffy, you know, more like traditional with a lot of decorating and everything else. I, for some reason inside, I start to get a little claustrophobic or something, but what drew you to the type of design that you execute on?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually interesting to hear that observation about it being calm. We've never really heard it be described that way, but I think, both me and my partner Anne Marie would, kind of really appreciate that. We're drawn to minimal spaces, but we also, you know, we're very client focused and client oriented, and often clients want different things. So some of our spaces end up becoming a little bit less minimal, and some end up becoming extremely minimal. But we do like to kind of at least bring that level of, I guess, refinement and some level of simplicity to all of our work. You know, some projects at either end of the spectrum of our work might not look like the same, came from the same architect or designer, but
there's a bell curve of like commonality in your work that is you know, it all looks like the same person had their hand in it, which is always a good, I'm probably putting my hand right in front of your face here and you stop that, which is, in my opinion, is a mark of talent that you don't necessarily there's not necessarily a heavy hand manipulating the end client to what you want. There's that kind of starchitect mentality that can happen. And then there's also this thing that you see a broad range of things, but you can see the golden thread that runs through it of that, you know, designer that comes through that I think is that mark of like, all right, someone's consistent and they know themselves and what they like, but they're also accommodating to a client, which is neat to see. So
yeah, it's great. I'm very happy you can see that in our work. We try very hard to do that without being kind of too overt in the process. We don't want to be just known as kind of a minimal Scandinavian firm, although that is kind of a little bit more of our
there's
aesthetic.
Worse things to get pegged as. So.
But yeah, I mean, we like diversity in our design. We like diversity in the program. We like diversity in our clients. So we do like to have that common thread of, you know, the aesthetic and approach. So that's really important to us. Yeah.
When you say diversity in clients, talk to me about like your ideal diversity of clients for your own business health and also for your own creative health.
Sure. Yeah. I guess, you know, our studio is multidisciplinary, so we are, you know, we're kind of a complete design studio. We like to consider, and we do architecture, interior design, we do branding, graphic design, wayfinding, signage. So kind of what we consider kind of a holistic approach to space. We don't see space as just being kind of, or architecture as being, you know, ceiling, walls, and floors, although that's kind of inherently what it is. We really see space as being kind of a cohesive approach to everything that's in it. It's kind of the soul of the space. You know, right now we're basically split 50-50 between hospitality and residential.
Oh, really?
Yes. And our hospitality tends to be all over the country.
Those are two things that have a lot of intersection, you know, as opposed to like commercial office space and residential.
Exactly. Yeah. So. There's kind of a domestic nature to hospitality space. So yeah. We tend to do, you know, bars and restaurants, and to the scale that's typically, I mean, it can get up to 10,000 square feet, but typically closer to, you know, 5,000 to 2,500 square feet. So, you know, you're talking about the level of, you know, a home.
Right.
So, and there's that same kind of tactility and I guess, again, domesticity to residential, that we kind of love that intersection of the two. And we also kind of love the diversity of clients. Like the hospitality clients are very different from residential clients. You know, they don't live in the space. They're essentially, I mean, they're an owner, or sometimes you have an owner's representative who are, you know, essentially, you know, they're kind of 9 to 5 as well. Like they leave at the end of the day and we all come together and design, and none of us are going to live there, but we're all kind of together trying to create a wonderful space for a third party that's going to come and enjoy the space.
Right.
Unlike residential, where most of the time the people who are your clients are going to be the ones living there. Sometimes you do vacation rentals or second homes where you have to think about other people as well. But you just get a different type of client in each scenario. And even within those two sectors, you get you know, very different kinds of clients who either want to be really hands-on or hands-off. But it's the diversity of those type of clients that keeps kind of the work interesting and keeps, I mean, if we were doing the same thing over and over, it'd become a little cookie cutter and we'd probably get a little bit bored of it. But because we have different types of clients coming from different parts of the country with different program requests, it's really great. And then on the hospitality side, we get to do a lot of the kind of branding and graphics in environmental graphics that go in the space as well, which is just a totally other world, still very spatial in our mind, but it again diversifies just the way we work and the way we approach a project.
Now, I worked with Util on their video that they did for, it was a large blue book the end result. What was the name? Streets?
I don't know. I don't know the name off the top of my head. Yeah.
It was something like that. Were you involved in that process? It was a lot of wayfinding, but then also design kind of standards for like different types of street types and everything else in Boston that they were kind of saying, this is the normalization, the starting point for understanding what Boston is and the variety of design types within Boston, if I remember it correctly.
Yes, I know the book. I don't know the name off the top of my head. I was not involved in it, but it kind of like speaks to the ethos of what Util is and kind of what they founded on.
Right.
I was the fourth employee at Util. Actually, it was my first job. I was there for, I don't know, 2.5 or 3 years or something out of undergrad. And I think a lot of what they do kind of instilled a lot of the way I would, you know, go on to approach design, as did many of my, you know, employers after that, as well as grad school.
Yeah.
But yeah, that kind of foundational, the way, I mean, they've partnered with other graphic designers and bookmakers in Boston. I think Over Under is one. But they do a lot of in-house stuff now too, I'm sure, but just the way that they approach kind of media as a, you know, medium of the book, as kind of a way to approach architecture is something that's always been kind of at the heart of the way at least I've seen design and the way that Anne-Marie and I have brought it into our practice. I got it before I went to grad school for architecture. I got a master's in media and focused on kind of media's role in architecture and how, I mean, because a lot of what we design, a lot of what we do and the way we approach architecture is not actually built. So it's all based on representation. You know, it's all in print or, you know, certainly nowadays, a lot of stuff is rendered. Right. And if you want to get really geeky, you know, CGI and movies and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, this is all architecture. It's just not the way we traditionally think about it.
Right, right.
So it's always been a fascination of mine. And it's why I think we've brought in that layer, kind of a much more practical layer of graphics and kind of printed form onto our architecture that I think is great. And why we love designing books and things like that for or menus for people, because it really is part of the whole experience.
I just had a conversation with Jessica Mann Amato at Mancini in New York, and they have a very immersive part of their practice where they go into like a virtual reality space as their design and can walk through and in real time kind of go through options. Mm-hmm. So they go through like a virtual reality tour of the space, and the client can say, now this countertop, if we were to change that, and they're all just standing there around this countertop, you know, you can see your client over there on the other side of the countertop represented in just like a green thing. So you kind of know where your client is, what they're looking at, what you're looking at. And then they're like, all right, let's push these buttons. And that changes the, you know, and I think it probably brings a lot of headache with it in some ways, I'm sure. But the overall end result is that there, it's a far more immersive experience to getting to that end design. And it's far more conceivable, I would imagine, to the client, where a lot of clients just cannot visualize, you know, what you've designed for them unless you're actually handing them a rendering of like a single point, you know, where you're standing and looking at something. And the things that she did say in this, in their practice of doing it, that their spaces between spaces are much more resolved because you can't hide it when you're in that virtual reality setting. Like normally you'd have these two spaces, and then in the transition space, the things that sometimes just go unresolved, you notice them, and the clients will inevitably point them out and say, like, what about this space? Can we resolve that a little more? And so it seems like a pretty interesting way of doing it. And I remember when I was in school that, you know, that was kind of the idea, and you could start to do fly throughs and stuff, but it was so archaic compared to now with all the video game technology. It's, I imagine it's weird.
It's also time consuming. So
I would imagine you got to have
a bit of
a staff.
If you're going to pull that into your practice. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You'd have to have some people that knew computers in the program only and just, you know, maintained that, I'd imagine. But talk to me about your location being Ontario, Canada, I'm imagining, Maine and LA.
Yeah, so we, AMP, started in LA about seven years ago. Anne-Marie and I met in grad school in New Haven, and then she moved to LA, I moved to New York, and about, I guess, 4 years later, we started AMP. And we're there for about 5 years, practicing and, you know, building our practice.
In LA?
In LA.
Okay.
Yep.
So you went from New York then to LA?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So I kind of made my way west for a while and then jumped as far east as I could back to Portland. But worked in Boston, worked in New York, grad school in New Haven, and then moved to LA for 5 years. So we kind of started there, again, very split between residential and hospitality from the start. You know, reasons being what they were, Anne-Marie moved to Toronto first, and then I moved to Portland sort of shortly after. And if you know the LA scape at all, she was on the west side, I was on the east side, which is about like an hour and a half to get to each other when we
you
started
were on
our practice.
The east side of LA?
I was on the east side.
So were you Inland Empire area?
No, I was I was in Silver Lake.
Okay.
Which is just kind of north of downtown.
Yep.
And she was in Venice. So, you know, we both had kind of home studios, young practice. So essentially, we got to learn to work remotely off the bat. So we were always, unless it was absolutely necessary, kind of working remotely, which is kind of a great little training session for what ended up happening with her moving to Toronto and me moving to.
This is no different. We got
exactly. So we really got used to it, and the transition to her being in Toronto and me being in Portland was really quite easy. And at the time, residential projects aside, because all of our residential clients were in LA, all of our hospitality clients were all over the country. So we had projects in Denver and in Louisville and in Boston. And those clients weren't corporate, but they were large enough that they were comfortable doing kind of, you know, they were already on Zoom and all of that kind of stuff pre-pandemic.
Right.
So it was very easy. So we became very facile before the pandemic of working remotely with clients, working remotely with each other. So it really hasn't been a challenge. excuse me. But what it has afforded us is kind of this ability to work, across the country and, you know, obviously over into Canada.
Right.
And our residential clients still tend to be a little bit more local in LA. Right now we have residential in all three cities, LA, Toronto, and Portland or Maine, you know, regional Maine. And then our hospitality clients still tend to be sort of all over. So, you know, in Providence and, I'm trying to think, Chicago, and we're dealing with some leads in Montana of all places. I mean, there's stuff coming in Texas, right. Actually, we're working on right now. So, it's kind of fun that we're able to work, kind of across the country and make it work.
Now, when COVID hit, how did that affect your business? Because the residential side of things, from everything that I've heard, it just skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And the hospitality just went dead. Like my hospitality clients that I shoot for, just non-existent over the last 2 years. While residential, like my commercial hospitality work dropped off, residential went up. Mm-hmm. Just because everyone's staying home and looking at where they work and reconsidering how much they're going to work from home and all that. Your hospitality, did it completely drop off or did it kind of like plateau? And
I mean, you basically described, you know, what happened probably, I mean, mostly across the board and what happened to us. We were fortunate enough to, right before the pandemic, it's actually unfortunate for our clients because then they had to go through the closure of their bars and restaurants right after. But
yeah,
we opened two of our bigger projects right in, you know, December of 2019, January 2020. So kind of right before the pandemic.
Yay!
I know. There was a big celebration and then a big sigh and a cry.
Someone opened a really nice restaurant just right down here, based almost on the river, like January before the pandemic. And to open a really nice restaurant in Biddeford is a huge risk.
Yeah.
It's there, you know, you're on the cutting edge at that point. And to be on the cutting edge and then to have COVID happen, like, ooh.
It's tough. Yeah, it's very tough. And, you know, we feel much more for our clients, but we were also very sad about this, you know, space that we had worked on for so, you know, for a year and a half apiece.
Right.
You know, suddenly had to close their doors and, you know, not kind of get the moment that we were hoping that they would have. But yeah, all that's to say that hospitality certainly, you know, took a plummet, right, when COVID happened. Residential kind of stayed a little flat, but it got a little slower because, you know, permitting, like processing with cities, we had a bunch of projects that were about to go into, you know, permits or having to deal with contractors and estimates and things. So all of that kind of slowed down. So while we didn't really lose any residential projects, there was a big delay in a lot of things. Things are, you know, halfway through, I would say COVID. I mean, I guess COVID's still going on, but, you know, halfway through the worst part, we started to get a lot of leads because a lot of people were spending a lot of time at home and property values were starting to go up. So that was kind of a good thing. But, and now we're seeing, you know, the rise of, you know, lumber costs and things like that.
I've heard that lumber futures are starting to go down.
Yes. I saw the same thing that made me very happy. Because we've had a project be delayed for 1 year because the clients were just, they just weren't going to pay the prices because they had a feeling it would go down.
Yeah.
Another one we're having estimated right now. And part of the reason it's so high is because lumber prices are so high. So again, maybe we'll have to wait, but it's been interesting. I guess the one hospitality project that kind of held steady during COVID is one that sort of went through, it's still going through a slow construction, but the construction continued during COVID, fortunately, outside of like the mandatory closures. But
right.
And that should hopefully be opening soon.
So how much time do you actually have to spend in LA when designing in LA? We take a good part. Why do we have so many wasps in here all of a sudden?
Okay, as long as they...
Or wait, one's a fly, one's a wasp. We'll survive.
It's the heat.
Not the fly, probably, but the wasp. with LA, we spend a fair amount of the winter in LA. I do some work out there while I'm out there. But I've also just through my interacting with that, I've heard about the ridiculously high cost if you're building new construction compared to renovating. And it seems like a very highly regulated place to do anything like that. What's the atmosphere like there compared to somewhere like Maine for something like that?
It is regulated, but I guess if you have been working with the city for a bit, you kind of know how to get through certain, I don't want to say hoops, but because you're going through all the regulations, but
right.
legal regulations, but you just sort of learn, I don't know, learn the tricks of the city. We in LA specifically, we will often work with expediters directly on both residential and hospitality, just because I mean, those people are, you know, at the city and know how to, you know,
so
make it
expediters
work.
Like you basically hire people to do the interacting with permits and all of that.
Exactly.
Like, all right, too much of a headache. You're great at it. You do it all the time.
Yes. So you know, we'll put together everything that has to do with the permit set, right? But you know, they'll be on board to process it with the city, but also do some consulting in the process to make sure that, you know, there's a lot, any city has nuances, but you know, LA has hillside areas and you know, corrosion zones erosion zones, or places that are subject to erosion, I should say. Earthquake. So that, you know, there's a lot of things that are specific about LA and California in general. California's just strict, but it hasn't really impeded the process or any projects really. And you know, every market in terms of contractor pricing it varies, but we haven't seen it. I mean, right now, of course, because of lumber and just supply of contractors are in such demand,
yeah,
are kind of spiking a little bit right now, but other than that, we haven't really seen it be too much of an issue.
What's your experience with finding skilled and qualified craftspeople in a place like LA compared to New England without offending your LA base?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because I have an opinion on it, and I imagine if I were to share my opinion and I was an architect, it would offend the people I maybe work with in LA, because the craftsmanship in New England, it's like you've got to make everything almost perfect because repent for winter is coming. Whereas
yes.
everything that I've experienced as far as the architectural construction side of it on the West Coast is just like, yeah, it gets like into the 50s here, no big deal, you know?
I guess a couple of things come to mind. One is, you know, every project is at the whim of the contractor and their subcontractors. I mean, yeah, the client and the architect gets to, you know, have a say and approve or reject subcontractors. But there's also a budget in mind. So sometimes when the budget doesn't permit, then it doesn't permit for great, I don't want to say subcontractors, they're qualified subcontractors, but, you know, there might be some extreme value engineering on millwork and all of that kind of
right.
stuff. So, you know, in LA, we've had both. So we've had really great subcontractors who are doing really great, you know, millwork and interiors, and you know, we visit their shop. You know, we'll go not quite to the, well, it might have been Inland Empire, but in that case, but yeah, we'll travel and we'll go to the shop and check out mock-ups and you know, look at samples, and it becomes this really kind of great interaction. Whereas other times, you know, when budget or schedule doesn't allow, the contractors are just, or both subcontractors are rushing around to finish the job. And we've had that experience on a project, and it ended up costing the subcontractor quite a bit because they cut corners and they had to end up essentially rebuilding everything. So,
yeah.
So I mean, you hit the nail on the head with that one, but we have had good experiences as well. So,
yeah, that part of your job I could not do.
Yeah.
The part where you have to go in and tell someone, I know you thought you were done and you were going to get a paycheck and move on, but you don't.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, I mean, it's contractual.
Yeah.
You know? They bought what's in the drawings and they have to build it to the way it's specified and drawn. So And in this case, it was very far off, so it was easy to make the case. There were concessions, but...
See that? It should have been here.
Yeah.
Yes. 3 feet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ouch. So what brought you to Maine? Like, why are you in Portland, Maine? I know why I'm here, because it's a great place.
Yeah.
But, like, what brought you here?
Well, many reasons. It's always a hard question to answer, because I get asked it a lot, coming from LA, because it seems like a very jarring thing for people, but... Which it
very
is.
Very jarring, did you
Not
say?
Not jarring, but people are surprised, you know, a move from LA to Maine.
Right.
On both ends of the spectrum, to be honest. When we tell people in LA that we were moving to Maine, it was a shock. And when we tell people in Maine that we moved from LA, it's also a shock. So
we had a waiter on our anniversary who was from San Diego. And if you've spent time in San Diego, it's sunny and 70 every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was like, why did you move here from that? Because she just likes to be warm. And he's like, after 30 years of 70 and sunny, it's just boring.
Yeah.
It's just boring. And now I have seasons and it's invigorating, you know?
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in New Hampshire to start. So
so you knew what you were getting into.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And like I told you, I kind of gradually made my way west.
Did you go through the Midwest?
No, I did not go through the Midwest. I jumped right over from New York to LA.
So you just flew right over.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But yeah, it was kind of, you know, coming back to the East Coast, being closer to family, you know, getting older, getting married, kids and all that. No kids yet, but kind of, you know, on the horizon, and just kind of getting out of bigger cities. Have been in really big cities, you know, for over 20 years. So yep. Still wanted city life, but... you know, just something a little bit smaller and access to nature and
right.
Things like that. I mean, before I moved to Maine, hadn't honestly been here much growing up, and some good friends from LA moved here 2 years before we did. So we started visiting them on our way to New Hampshire, and I mean, probably, you know, 3 or 4 times a year. And every time we did it, it was just like, okay.
This is
where
bad.
I'm living. Yeah, this is great.
Good.
I mean, it kept getting better and better every single time. So
right.
It's kind of
right.
Jumped.
Yeah,
in.
It's a really interesting thing to have been in Biddeford since 2003. And like when we moved here, my parents were just like, what are you doing here? And now, you know, however many years later, they live, you know, just right outside
exactly.
of town. And it's amazing to see the transformation, like the. And interestingly, hospitality design was the kind of the spark that really switched the tide of downtown here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's still not, you know, old port Portland. But when we moved here, 80 to 85% of males on Main Street in the middle of summer would be shirtless. And now it's down to like... 20%.
Yeah, you know? I saw some of the 20% on my way in. So
yeah, they're you know, they're staying cool, and they don't have to put a shirt on. So you know, why would they?
Yep.
So you know, that's cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, things have changed, and it's interesting to see. But you also struggle with the idea of gentrification and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
We had an art project a while ago with Heart of Biddeford right before COVID, and we had a proposal in through Heart of Biddeford with, I believe it was Tammy Ackerman at the time, where we were going to put, like, you know, do interviews and take someone's interview that was, you know, from Biddeford for as long as they've been alive, like 3 stories high, like the bust of this person with a quote referencing something, you know, about gentrification in downtown. And I think it would have been a really, really cool thing to have this 3-story high portrait of a person with, you know, like a quote from them about, you know, art and nice restaurants are great, but where am I supposed to go?
Yeah.
You know, that's a real thing. Like, I want to be here, own property, and for the value to go up. But what does it do to the people who need jobs around here that aren't starting businesses or anything else? You know, it's an odd thing, but
it is. And you know, gentrification is obviously a touchy subject, and you know, nobody wants gentrification. And cities, you know, cities have to grow and cities have to develop. So I think a lot of people at this stage, you know, because it's an evolving process, but you know, it's about densification and it's about affordability. So as long as you can densify intelligently, so you're not, you know, you don't want sprawl. You don't want to, we want to preserve the way that Maine is, the character, you know, in which we all love. But, you know, finding opportunities in cities and small towns to densify and create affordable housing and affordable approaches to living in cities that are close to, you know, workplaces and hospitals and restaurants and things like that. So,
yeah. I imagine one of the more feasible ways of doing that would be amending the code of Biddeford. Right now, the codes are that if you're going to have a all the workers for when the mills were active lived in Biddeford primarily, mm-hmm. and all the administration lived in Saco primarily. So in Saco, you have generally more single family homes of a larger, nicer scale. And then in Biddeford, there's a lot more like multi-unit housing, mm-hmm. that's not always the most spacious or nice or whatever. And so I think they reactively adjusted their codes to be very preventative of adding more units at all. Mm-hmm. But if they could have a thing that says, all right, you've got a single family home, you can add a unit of up to 25-30% of your normal square footage. Mm-hmm. That's what Kennebunkport and everything else does as an in-law apartment or whatever. In Biddeford, it's just basically you've got to have like 2 acres in most of the zones to be able to have even 2 units, or you've got to be like right in downtown on the MSRD 1 or something. It's not easy where other areas it could be more flexible and allow for more of that, especially with this economy and everything now where people are making more money commonly off of like Airbnb, mm-hmm. or like doing Uber or something like that. It allows for people to own while still paying for what is a fairly expensive place to live.
Yeah.
You know, the taxes aren't, you know, this is not the Midwest.
No.
There's a bit of maintenance that has to go on with a lot of things, and there's a lot of property value on the coast and everything else. But
yeah, the way property taxes are going up and just property values and things like that, I mean, having that, you know, option to be able to add some sort of level of supplemental income, like an ADU,
right,
would be extremely helpful. And I think it's, you know, it's, I mean, LA is only just, to use them as an example, they've only just adopted kind of more progressive ADU, accessory dwelling unit policies that allows it, you know, allows, you know, tighter lots and, you know, different locations that didn't permit them before to be able to happen. So I just think, you know, it takes time for cities to evolve, but hopefully, hopefully they'll start to realize the need.
Right. Talk to me about your creative process when you start to interact with a client. Like, where do you, like, where's the line between your emotional approach to something, mm-hmm. and your cognitive approach to something, and how you involve a client in that?
Sure. Yeah. I guess one of the things we love about starting a project with a client is our discovery process. So at the beginning of concept design, we will have a somewhat lengthy, I think lengthier than most studios or firms, discovery process where we really get to know the client. Just by talking, I mean, we have exercises, you know, there's a presentation that we're looking at, but it tends to be a little bit more word-based just to kind of trigger conversations and thought starters. So we'll try to get to what are the client's core values? What are their core attributes? What maybe are some of the personas that they might identify with? It's just kind of like a fun series of exercises in which we can get to know the client in a way that is outside of design. Because, you know, clients and designers and architects will all come to, and consultants, to be honest, you know, structural engineers, MEP, will all come to the table with preconceived ideas, even though it's a fresh project and everyone wants to start something, the goal is to, you know, start the project off the ground conceptually. But before we get into concepts or anything, we go through that round with our clients to get everything kind of on the table, you know, to get to know our clients' personalities. They can get to know our personalities, and hopefully kind of discover something new. So, you know, everyone knows the program, like, you know, it's going to be a 3-bedroom house with a, you know, a pool, or it's going to be a 2,500 square foot bar that's underground. So that's a given. In some cases, sometimes discovery process will bring out new
things.
I don't
have an underground bar.
No. No, an actual bar, not a
I
bar
make
in a
joke,
house.
But
that'd be lavish.
I did hear a story, though, of a guy who designed a home for, I believe it was Glenn Close's husband, who their house is out like on Prout's Neck or something. And right as the shovel on the excavator was about to scoop, he gets a phone call, the architect, and he's like, the owner is like, can we put a squash court in the basement?
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And he's like, hold the trouble. You know, he's like, oh, my goodness.
We might need to go back to the permit.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And also lavish. But yes. Sounds nice.
It's a nice. It is a nice house, though.
Yeah, I believe it. I definitely believe it. But yeah, I mean, just kind of, again, getting everything out while the process is still fresh rather than, I mean, things are obviously discovered in schematic and design development and hopefully not construction documents and such. But, you know, the sooner we can get everything out and everyone talking about what they want of the project, and maybe not even what they want of the project. But again, you just learn personalities and you learn how to work with people in that process. So we see our process as being very democratic and we kind of pride ourselves in that. And our clients tend to really like it.
Now, how is your process democratic? How do you facilitate a democratic design process?
Well, I think the discovery process is a big one. You know, just really spending a lot of time with our clients in the beginning and not coming to our first meeting with a bunch of sketches and things like that. We would never do that.
So you're basically just talking and listening and sharing in that.
Exactly. And there are images and stuff too, right? You know, kind of looking, you know, because, you know, some clients will come with a Pinterest board.
Right.
And some clients don't. But, you know, getting ideas from Pinterest are great, but also bringing a whole new set of images that maybe they hadn't thought about that they can react to and say, you know, I like that. I don't like that. I really don't like that. And we always tell our clients, like, please tell us the stuff you really don't like, because that's
right,
kind of the
right.
most important to us. And we know what to stay away from.
Like, a lot of times if I'm working with a new client and they do mention how a photographer has failed in the past with them, that's stuff that I really hone in on. And I'm like, well, tell me about this. Why did they fail? Because it applies to every other client I have, really. That here's a unique situation where someone's been let down and they probably weren't comfortable enough to actually tell the photographer. They probably just didn't work with them again. And so you get that opportunity to, like, well, what did they do wrong?
Exactly.
Why don't
you
like
their nuances
that?
And what they don't like. So yeah, it's great. And, you know, to some degree, residential is a little bit more straightforward than hospitality, but you know, the discovery process gives us a really great opportunity to get into the brand of a you know, a bar, or restaurant, or hotel, and gets us into, you know, how much of the environmental graphics and branding and wayfinding do you want to be a part of it? Like, all of that kind of goes into it as well. So those tend to be quite lengthy discovery meetings.
Now, do you insist or do you hope that you get to do everything on a project as far as from architecture to interior design to branding to wayfinding? Like,
we never insist. You know, when we can, we'll put together our proposals to include all of it so that the client will, you know, hopefully consider it as a kind of cohesive and holistic design process. But, you know, sometimes people come in with either, you know, an architect on board already, or interior designer on board already, or a graphic designer on board. So, you know, if that's already the case, then, you know, we will work around that and we're flexible. But yeah, ideally, I mean, we would love that. And that goes for residential as well. I mean, there tends to be obviously less graphic design and branding with residential, but, you know,
if you need wayfinding in your house.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
But, hey, you know, street letter signage, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's none of that, not much, or there's none of that, but, you know, interior design and architecture, to be able to do both, you know, I mean also like furniture selection, you know, all the furniture in the house as well.
I've run into projects that had great architecture and great interior design, but they went horribly together. Like, you had this talented interior designer and talented architect, but they're after the architecture, there wasn't enough understanding of what the architecture was communicating for the interior design to take note from. You know, it just kind of was all on its own and didn't consider the architecture, and it was too big for the space and it had to be removed and new stuff. And
yep. And that's what we tell our clients in the beginning when we're, you know, on biz dev calls or anything, before we even put proposals together, before we start a process, is, you know, the that's what's so great about the discovery process and having more things included in the design process, like interior design and architecture, is that the discovery process unpacks all of that together. So you really are talking, especially when it comes to hospitality, you're talking about graphic design, you're talking about furniture, you're talking about the architecture, you're talking about, you know, the wallpaper on the walls. Like, all of that is discussed, you know, in one of the those are kind of more later discovery sessions, but it's really kind of all unpacked at the same time, rather than, okay, the architecture is done, most of the interior finishes are done, but then you bring in a designer to bring in all the furniture and another designer to bring in the graphics. It's like they weren't part of those conversations. So they don't, I'm sure they could execute really well and the space could look really beautiful, but it's just,
there's an X factor involved might go missing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you had the opportunity to design your own space that you live in?
No, now, in short, but, kind of pseudo going through that right now. Bought like a three-story Victorian in Portland, okay, and, you know, good bones, but needs a little bit of work. So
what
it's kind of a little bit longer of a process.
So like, how much are you gonna, like, if I bought a three-story Victorian, I would be turning the inside into a minimalist dream while leaving the exterior. Probably, I probably fall victim to like painting the whole exterior black just to do it, because I think it would be awesome. But what are you going to do?
Well, it is being painted actually in the next couple of weeks. It was hard waiting a couple of years with the putrid color that's on it right now. But, you know, so it goes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's getting
painted.
What
color was it?
It's sort of a mustardy.
Mustardy.
that's being nice. But kind of a mustardy color that's, you know, it needs to be painted, so it's getting chipped away. But you know, mustardy color with green accents. Yeah, but and that can be okay with the right tones, but these are not the right tones.
Right. It sounds horrible when I imagine it. I'm sure it's not as horrible.
Our neighbors were delighted when we told them we were getting it painted.
Yeah. And that's funny. Like, any change you ever reference in a neighborhood, usually people go, "No," they're like, "Yeah, no, that's great, good." Yeah. That's funny.
So we are going very dark on the exterior.
Cool.
Very excited to, you know, just kind of monochrome, like, you know, tone on tone, you know, change in sheens with the trim and the siding. But other than that, it's pretty much all monochrome. And then the interior, before we moved in, the previous owners were very wonderful people, but had been living there for over 30 years. So, you know, it was kind of 30-year-old interior or later. You know, I'm sure they fixed some stuff in the process, but just had everything stripped and painted white on the inside, took down a couple walls. And yeah, so essentially a long way to say what you might do as well, but making a little bit more interior. We love old houses. So that's why, you know, we bought a three-story Victorian, but, you know, keeping a lot of the bones and character of the house.
Yeah. Now, are you doing any movements of like keeping the front facade and everything else, but then doing like a really minimalist large glass expanse on a backyard or something? Or
nothing like that right now. We're focusing on just kind of redoing the interior, you know, new kitchen, new bathrooms, all that kind of stuff. Which is, you know, going to be a several year process, but we are looking at ways of reconfiguring, you know, the garage, for instance. So that's a little bit down the line, but so it's mostly a retrofit. You know, no new architecture, but in kind of related, Anne-Marie, my partner in Toronto, she and her husband are in the process, and we're the architect for it, are putting a two-story addition onto their home in Toronto. So while I haven't designed...
Two-story addition on top of their home?
Yeah, so they have a two-story multifamily home
that
they live in, and they're adding two more stories on top of it.
Whoa,
yeah, it's kind of a
design.
Beautiful. Yeah, it's a really beautiful little mid-century gem. It's like just kind of a cube. It used to be a I want to say doctor's office, but I almost want to say dentist, but whatever. They're both doctors. Just a little office, and it was converted to residential years ago. And it's been really fun going through the process with them, especially Anne-Marie and I have worked so closely on so many other projects for so long. So we've been working on over the last year. It's recently gone in for permit, and yeah, it's fun. You know, I'm kind of living through her eyes to see her design her own space, and like, how as an architect do you design your own space that you're going to live in?
Yeah. I have my master's in architecture, practiced for a few years, and didn't enjoy, having to be in the same location so consistently, to put it short. But I always was constantly had like a working model of the house I would design. And my wife and I were able to build 3 years ago now, and it's a really rewarding experience, and you really realize how much a new build, like, this is all like coming from nothing to something, essentially. And the feel of a tailored fit that you knew how you lived and were able to execute that. Mm-hmm. I mean, my friend Caleb Johnson, you know, corrected an immense amount of things that I messed up in just the schematic design of it, mm-hmm. fixed it all, and then did the contract documents and everything else, and really did a great job. And we're super happy with it. But that experience of paying attention to how you live, and then knowing what you need, and then being able to design and create and see it come to life, mm-hmm. is just, it was such a painful, but so magical at the same time to eventually see the space, and you're just like, wow, this is happening. And like to see, like, we have one big expanse of glass that looks out over the yard, and it's pretty close to the ground level, and it's floor to ceiling. So it just has that feeling of like, I just want to lay on the floor here. And mm-hmm. like when it first, like the drywall got painted and there was a little bit of, you know, a tiny bit of landscaping as far as like the sand that they had brought in had been leveled outside a little bit. Like I took a lawn chair and just sat in the middle of where the living room would be. And I just kind of like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
You know, but it has that minimalist thing that just conveys calm to me. And yep. then anything that you add in there, it's more of an additive process after you've subtracted all the weirdness out that came with every other house that
exactly.
you lived in.
It's a little more curated.
Yeah. You're able to curate your experience and what makes you feel warm in there. And now you have a romantic partner of some mm-hmm. sort, it sounds like, that you're with,
yep.
husband.
Yep.
How hard is it for your husband to live with someone who is so design oriented? Because in my case, it's very hard for my wife to not have as much of a say in our living space because I'm so opinionated, which mm-hmm. for our stereotypical arrangement of me, man, you, woman, and usually the stereotype is that the woman's going to be picking out the drapes, mm-hmm. making her. And I'm like the one that was like, no, we have to get this kind of couch because it reflects this and that, and we have mm-hmm. to do this, and I want that on the wall. I can be a lot very overbearing and controlling with my space. And that's kind of not disorienting, but it makes her feel less like it's her space because I have such a strong opinion. And to diverge from that opinion eats away at my core of what I think should be. So it's a very hard thing to balance and be non-selfish mm-hmm. with that, you know? How has that been your experience?
It's been okay, actually. It's been pretty great. I guess the good thing is, so he very much trusts my design aesthetic and my architectural approach.
Please tell me he's an accountant and he's just like, whatever you do is great, I love it.
No, he writes cocktail books and owns bars and things like that.
Okay, so it sounds like he's pretty creative as well.
Yes.
But if he's writing, his creative space might be in a different way than necessarily visual.
Yes, but he is, I would say, well-suited, you know, kind of visually too. You know, design-wise, it's great. I mean,
yeah.
So, I mean, for instance, I guess, you know, you talked about an architect designing their own house. Like, to me, like, that's, you know, I'm very excited to do that one day. And it also gives me a little bit more anxiety than... you know, I feel very comfortable designing a home, listening to a client, doing all that kind of stuff.
Right,
but when
right.
it's mine, it's like, oh boy.
Yeah, you have this feeling like, I'm going to do it once.
Right.
I don't want to do it again.
Right.
I just have to do it once. So it's got to be perfect.
Yes. But. So he has been the most wonderful, like, sounding board and actually, you know, designer too. Like, you know, sometimes I'll have anxiety about picking, you know, a certain sofa for my own home, and then he'll just pick one. I'm like, oh yeah, that's great, actually.
Huh.
So it works out really well. It kind of alleviates some of the pressure of that I feel that, you know, about selecting my own furniture or things like that.
Interesting.
But because I also like so many things, like I've been exposed to so many things in the design process, it's sort of hard to choose. So it helps when he just kind of comes to the table with a couple. I'm like, okay, yeah, that one.
Yeah.
But that's worked And then luckily we have the same aesthetic. I mean, he immediately wanted to paint the house dark as well and painted everything inside minimal and white. It's just, you know, we're constantly eyeing lake houses and things like that. And we are always drawn to the same kind.
We just wanted to take a quick outro here to thank everybody for listening. The podcast is taking off somewhat. We seem to be getting a lot of requests from architects outside of our regional influence that enjoy coming on the show and talking about design theory and everything else. You can definitely email us at info@trentbell.com or tim@trentbell.com and let us know how we're doing, what you'd like to hear more of, or if you'd like us to just stop producing this content because it's really annoying. So let us know what you think. Hit us up. We really appreciate it. And have a great day.